One of the things I'm thankful for is the choir. And even for Bob Scott, the director of it, despite the fact that early this morning, as often happens at odd hours, he called me and addressed me by the name of the person he thought he was calling. For his kind of talent, you forgive all sorts of mistakes. We've been reminded for several weeks of the Halloween party tonight down at Bill and Susan Selby's home on a beautiful little sandpit lake, and we hope many of you will come. It's a good excuse for getting families together, so that the kids can fortify themselves with hot dogs and roasted marshmallows before they ride off into the haunted night on a hay wagon to enjoy being frightened. Since we are Protestants, most of us have no idea what Halloween is, except a time to buy pumpkins and hang skeletons on the door and turn the porch light on for little trick-or-treaters whose mothers, when they get back home, if they are good mothers, will carefully sort through what we have given them and throw half of it away. Kids have a great time with Halloween. The hangover is seldom serious, and it's a profitable season for a consumer-oriented society. So we sit back and enjoy it, even if we don't know exactly what the whole thing is supposed to mean. The real Halloween, of course, is on Tuesday evening, to be followed on Wednesday by something known as All Saints' Day, devised long ago by Catholic Christians as a way of honoring all the saints, but especially the ones that do not already have days named for them. Sort of a catch-all, just in case we've missed anybody. The evening before All Saints' Day came to be known as All Hallows' Eve, the evening of all the holy ones. If you say that fast, the way the English do, it shortens very easily from All Hallows' Eve to Halloween. And whatever it may have meant once upon a time, what it means now is a night for goblins and ghosts, dry leaves skittering on the pavement, the hiss of a humpbacked black cat, the shrill cackle of a witch on a broomstick, always by some ancient perversity, a woman. The word Halloween now has nothing much to do with religion. In a living language, holy days and special words change their meaning until they become unrecognizable. You have already guessed, of course, that this is not really going to be a sermon about Halloween. I brought up that word so that I could work my way to something else. I noticed in a religious magazine that the Bible lesson for the day after Halloween included a rather surprising name. In the list of the saints, suddenly, there is this remark: by faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish with those who were disobedient. If she had been Rahab the Sunday school teacher, or Rahab the choir soloist, or Rahab the president of the Women's Guild, we'd not be surprised. But Rahab the prostitute? What's she doing listed among the saints in the book of Hebrews. Whatever it is, it's not an accident, because her name shows up again in the book of James, where she is one of just two people listed. There is Abraham, the father of the faithful, and there is Rahab, the streetwalker from Jericho. What an odd pair they make, until we begin to understand the peculiar realism of the Bible. You know Abraham's story. What about hers? Well, she comes on stage when Joshua has led the Israelites to the edge of the promised land and decides to send in two spies to look things over. They end up somehow at Rahab's place in a seedy part of town. The Bible chooses not to comment on why they came to her place, but when the mayor got word that enemy spies were prowling about, he sent his own men out to capture them. Knowing something of the popularity of her establishment, they showed up there after a while to ask their questions, but Rahab protected the two spies with a lie. "It's true," she says, "that men came to me, but I did not know where they came from, and when the city gate was to be closed at dark, they left. If you hurry, maybe you can catch them." So off they run, Keystone Cops, not knowing that she has hidden her guests under some piles of flax up on the roof. She tells the two lucky spies that she has heard of their God and his power, and all she asks is that when the Israelites come back in force, they will show her family mercy. They promise that they will, so she lets them down by a rope through the window and over the wall. Probably not the first gentleman to leave her place that way. And then she ties a scarlet rope on her house to identify it for the troops when they arrive. They keep their word, and the house with the red thread in the red light district is the only one spared when Jericho bites the dust. We can understand the bargain. What's hard is to make sense of how this woman winds up being listed so prominently among the saints. Rahab, a harlot and a liar. Not very promising stuff for inclusion in the Holy Hall of Fame. But then, to be honest about it, not much worse after all than many of the rest. Remember them for a moment. Poor Noah, just out of the boat and so drunk in his tent that he embarrassed his sons. The desert chieftain, Abraham, with his squabbling family. Hot-headed Moses, who began his career by murdering a man in a fit of rage. Lustful David, who stole one of his soldiers' wives and then lied and had the man killed to cover it up. Cowardly Simon Peter, who swore an oath that he never knew the Galilean by the name of Jesus. And Paul, the great apostle, so much a bigot and chauvinist at times, and exploding at other times with some of the nastiest threats you've ever read. What an honest book the Bible is about the rogues gallery God has managed somehow to use. More and more, it seems to me that the Bible tries very hard to keep us from looking down on other people, about licking our lips when the gossip gets hot and juicy, about thinking that the world is divided neatly into saints and sinners, good people and bad people. I don't know whether I can make you believe it, but my reading of the Bible leaves me in no doubt at all that if we were to list all the failures of the church, the worst ones, the very worst one, at the top of the list would be the ugly, bloated thing that is called self-righteousness. I have a friend down in Denton, Texas, who edits a little monthly magazine and does a great deal of speaking in churches around the country. In recent months, he has been going to different churches in his hometown and writing about them for his readership. He has visited liberal churches and some that are very fundamentalist, white churches and black churches, rich churches and little storefront places with lettuce crates for seats. And in each one, he found some things he liked and some things he didn't like much. And he wrote about all those reactions. His readers enjoyed his shopping around and recording his responses until about a week ago, when he visited a gay church and wrote with his usual sympathy and understanding about that one. And then suddenly the letters to the editor section wasn't big enough to print them all. Some supportive, some terribly angry and full of disgust with my friend for having treated that church with his usual courtesy. I read every one of those letters with great interest, and what seemed clearer than anything else was that some of the writers had totally forgotten that the church is made up of people urgently in need of God's grace, had forgotten that if the church is really made up of the righteous, then it comes under the judgment of Jesus himself, who spoke a parable to those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. In that story, the only person recognized as truly righteous was a man who knew he wasn't, and who prayed, "O God, be merciful to me, a sinner." If I think of myself in any other way, I am self-righteous and in trouble. No church should get through a Sunday without being reminded that it is a meeting place for those who struggle, not for those who sit piously on some pinnacle of goodness and gaze primly down at the benighted souls beneath them. Remember, please, that the righteous do not need a church, not any more than a teetotaler needs Alcoholics Anonymous. And that organization strikes me, by the way, as one of the best illustrations I know of what a church is meant in considerable part to be. In an AA meeting, each person readily admits to needing help. In their mutual sharing, they begin by saying, "Hi, my name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic." No pretending anymore, no self-deceit. The honest truth about what they are, and they accept one another unconditionally. If one falls, there is someone present to help. They reach out in love and start over with one goal: to be sober today. When you read about how early Christians felt about their Sunday meetings, it becomes clear at once that AA is really more like primitive Christianity than most modern churches are. Can you imagine visiting a lovely, respectable church and having someone greet you like this? "Good morning, my name is Frank, and I'm a bit of a failure, I'm afraid, in many ways. In fact, all of us in this place are like that, looking to God and to each other for some help as we try to get better. Maybe you could help us. Perhaps we could help you." You may not have noticed, but I've been avoiding the use of a word I dislike very much and almost never say from the pulpit, which is strange in a way because it may be the commonest word spoken from pulpits. I didn't have Frank say he was a sinner because that word does not seem very useful to me anymore. What it once meant has been covered up by careless speech until it has become one of those catch-all words pulpits are fond of. When that happens to a word, it helps sometimes to go back to its roots. The Greek word is hamartion. It means literally missing the mark. It's a figurative expression drawn from a sport like archery. We shoot an arrow, we miss the mark. All around us, our friends are also missing the mark. Not on purpose, usually. More likely, we miss it by accident. We were too weak to get the arrow all the way to the target. We let go the shaft too quickly. We were nearsighted, some such thing. So to say that we are all sinners, which is what Christ said about us, is simply to say in the original expression that we have all missed the mark. Now, I can use that phrase without the slightest touch of awkwardness, because it hasn't been spoiled. The word sin smells like revival sawdust and the sweat of Bible-pounding preachers. It hisses on the lips of pulpiteers who make it sound as if there were two neatly separated classes of people, the good and the bad, the sinners and the righteous. That distorts the Bible. "Why call me good?" Jesus said sharply. "There is no one good but God. I am myself," Paul admits, "chief of sinners." If that is false modesty, then it is reprehensible. If he means it, where does it leave me? I have never read about or met a great Christian who was not filled with a sense of her own faults. To be any other way is to be that thing called self-righteous, the most deplorable attitude named in the New Testament. You know, of course, that no self-righteous person is ever silly enough to think that he is perfect. What he does is to rank human weakness. And yours is always worse than his. He may be eaten up with envy and hatred, but he imagines that the wino in the park is a sinner, and he isn't. This is not how Scripture takes our measure. All of us have missed the mark. Not some outside the church, unconventional, in trouble with the law. Not some, but all of us have missed the mark. And we know the ways in which we have missed it. If we're honest, we aimed to be calm and patient, but we blew up. We missed the mark. We meant to forgive, but emotion got the better of us, and we said things that make reconciliation all but impossible. We missed the mark. In a moment of weakness and fear, we lied. We took more than was rightfully ours. We cheated the customer. We knowingly sold inferior, even dangerous goods. We were jealous of somebody else's success. In all those ways, we missed the mark. We all miss it. And in that old classic sense of the word, we are all sinners. Do you want a good rule to follow? Regret the mistakes you see in your own heart more than the ones you see in the rest of us. Knowing how often you miss the mark, be gentle and patient with those whose arrow also falls short. Can you do that?